Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present labor and racial justice activist Bill Fletcher Jr., who assesses the current state of the U.S. labor movement, the Obama administration's agenda, and the dangers and opportunities in this November's midterm election. Hussein Ibish, senior fellow at the American Task Force on Palestine, who assesses a new round of Israeli-Palestinian peace talks and the obstacles that stand in the way of reaching an agreement. And Patty Lovera, of the group Food and Water Watch, who talks about the recent recall of salmonella-tainted eggs and the danger of factory farming and need for adequate inspections and enforcement. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Great Recession has struck a severe blow to the tough-on-crime agenda of imposing longer sentences on criminals and building more prisons. Even in conservative states like Texas, Alabama, and Georgia, fiscal reality has set in as state governments have adopted cheaper and more humane alternatives to harsh prison sentences. The Texas prison population increased tenfold from 1972 to 2008. And in 2007, the state decided to end a major prison expansion project in favor of a less expensive plan to increase investment in drug and alcohol treatment services. For the first time in decades, the prison population in the Lone Star State has started to decline. Kansas has followed suit by increasing drug treatment programs for parolees as part of an effort to prevent ex-offenders from committing new drug-related crimes. According to The Nation magazine, 10 states have now embraced a justice reinvestment strategy, which combines reductions in prison spending while diverting funds to community-based anti-crime initiatives. In a strange twist on economic globalization, Europe's largest financial giant, Grupo Santander, bought the Boston-based Sovereign Bank, which may provide a unique opportunity to unionize bank tellers. Outside of the United States, 75% of Santander's bank branches are unionized, mostly in Europe and Latin America. Yet today, less than 1% of U.S. bank employees belong to trade unions. Now the Service Employee International Union, with the aid of Brazilian and European unions, has launched a drive to organize U.S. bank tellers, starting with Santander. According to the news magazine In These Times, bank tellers and personal bankers typically make $10 to $12 an hour, less than unionized janitors make. After buying out Sovereign, Santander fired 3 union activists, along with 23% of its workforce. The European bank also slashed work hours and health benefits. Big banks that received billions in taxpayer bailout funds can easily afford to pay bank tellers a living wage. With less than 4% of all Wall Street bonuses, banks could give 500,000 bank tellers a $2 an hour raise and provide them with 100% employer-paid health benefits. Some right-wing politicians have boosted their prospects in the run-up to the midterm election, in part by portraying President Obama as a radical bent on imposing government control over the economy and attacking the American spirit of entrepreneurial capitalism. The most commonly used example by GOP operatives is the heavy government involvement in the bailout of General Motors. In the spring, the U.S. government owned 61% of GM's stock and led the restructuring of the ailing car company. For now, the Obama bailout appears to have paid off, with rising sales of American cars and the restructured GM planning to go public with a new initial public offering. McAllister College labor historian Peter Ratcliffe says GOP critics like Dick Morris and Newt Gingrich have gone to the extreme in criticizing Obama. Ratcliffe told the Christian Science Monitor, "Socialism suggests getting rid of capitalism altogether. Mr. Obama is not within a million miles of an ideology like that." Billy Wharton, co-chair of the Socialist Party USA, quipped, "I am not even sure Obama is even a liberal. I call him a hedge fund Democrat." During the Great Depression in the 1930s, progressive President Franklin Roosevelt was often accused of being a socialist by his opponents. "This is ironic," notes Colorado College presidential historian Tom Cronin. "In retrospect, FDR is the one who helped capitalism survive." It is with deep sorrow that we report the passing of Reverend Lucius Walker. Reverend Walker was executive director of Pastors for Peace and the Interreligious Foundation for Community Organization in New York. In 1992, he organized the first caravan of humanitarian aid to the people of Cuba and led a total of 21 trips to Cuba in defiance of the U.S. embargo by not applying for the requisite license. A little over 1 month after celebrating his 80th birthday with friends in Cuba, Reverend Lucius Walker died peacefully in his home on Tuesday, September 7th. During the past 2 decades, Reverend Walker was a frequent guest on Between the Lines. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon and Denise Manzari. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
The state of working America was grim as the nation commemorated Labor Day 2010. Unemployment stands at 9.6%, while housing foreclosures remain at record levels. Private sector job creation is moving in a positive direction, but remains weak. Last year's injection of $814 billion of stimulus funds into the economy may have helped prevent a full-blown depression, but has not yet produced a recovery. As workers struggle to make ends meet in this bad economy, labor unions continue to lose membership, now down to 12.1% of the workforce. President Obama, speaking at a Labor Day event in Milwaukee, attacked Republicans for policies which he says caused the worst economic decline since the Great Depression, while proposing a new $50 billion jobs bill to rebuild roads, railways, and runways. The president is also expected to propose an increase and permanent extension of the research and development tax credit and permit companies to write off 100% of their new investments in plant and equipment through 2011. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with longtime labor and racial justice activist Bill Fletcher, who is the past president of Trans-Africa Forum, former vice president for international trade union development at the AFL-CIO, and founder of the Black Radical Congress. Fletcher talks about the current state of the U.S. labor movement, disappointments in the Obama administration's agenda, and the dangers and opportunities in this November's congressional midterm election.
The problem is that this administration has too often backed away from taking the steps it needs to take because of their absolute fear that they'll be criticized by Fox News and the various other pundits on the political right. And so they took some steps that were valuable, that were important, but were just simply insufficient. Now, you add on to that the weak state of organized labor, and this compounds the problem, because instead of there being a large mass out there of millions of people that are pushing this administration, you have a much weakened union movement, and a union movement that, as we try to say in our book, Solidarity Divided, is itself much too cautious. I mean, one of the things that, you know, is going to happen October 2nd is that there's going to be a massive demonstration for jobs in Washington, D.C. This is tremendous. The NAACP and 1199 SEIU were the originators of this, and other unions have jumped in and other groups. That's great. The question that I ask is, why weren't we doing this in 2009? Why weren't we doing this in the fall of 2008? And I think that that speaks to some of the structural and ideological problems in organized labor.
Bill, there are many people critical of the Obama administration for its anemic response to the constant barrage of attacks from the right. There seems to be a lack of response, in the judgment of many, to the constant attack on the working people of this country, the obstacles the GOP has put in front of unemployment insurance packages, as well as their attempt to continue the Bush tax cuts, the massive Bush tax cuts for the wealthiest people in the country. If there ever was a case for class warfare, certainly the GOP, since the Reagan era, could be accused of it, and the Democrats don't seem to have much of a response. Why not?
For a few reasons. And some that are very particular to Obama and others that are more general. So at the more general level, part of what we're dealing with is that many of the top leaders in the Democratic Party and the top opinion makers are those who were shaped by certain economic theories that became very important and very prominent in the 1980s and 1990s, specifically something that came to be known as neoliberalism. This whole idea of let the market run wild and that ultimately that will be the producer of wealth. And so what's happened is that the larger corporations, their political and economic advisors, have pushed the Democratic Party to the right, contrary to what someone like Glenn Beck would say. They've pushed them to accommodate themselves to the needs of the major corporations. And this has been to the disservice of working people. Now, I think part of what's going on with Obama is what I just laid out, plus some other factors. One is that President Obama, as the first African-American president of the United States, is deeply fearful of being portrayed or perceived as the angry black man. And one of the things that we've got to understand, and this is where race politics becomes very important, and a lot of people don't want to talk about it, is that there is, in the United States, a very deep concern among many, many whites about angry black folks, and that when black people get angry, many white people get nervous. And if you have a president who happens to be black who gets angry, oh boy, let's watch out. So one of the things that Obama has been doing ever since he was on the campaign trail has been to be the mild-mannered reporter for a great metropolitan newspaper, as he used to say in the beginning of Superman, with the idea that he's not going to show great anger, great emotion. He was going to be very calm. And a lot of regular folks don't get this, but I think we have to factor in this issue of race. So you have a combination of class politics that have influenced the upper echelons of the Democratic Party, and then you have the issue of race. And the result is that we have an administration that instead of raising the rabble against what FDR, President Roosevelt, called in the 1930s the economic royalists, you have this attempt by the administration constantly to compromise with people who want to destroy the administration. The issue then is that there needs to be a force, and I've argued time and again that the principal force needs to be organized labor, that is pushing this administration and pushing Congress and saying that if you're fearful of the right, you better watch out because you really should fear us. We're going to be the ones that are going to be pushing you, and we're not going to remain silent in the name of aiding the other side. We're going to be pushing you and forcing you to live up to your promises. You know, no matter what criticisms we have of President Obama, we do not need to return to power the same idiots that got us into this mess. So we've got to turn out and vote. But then, in addition, we've got to keep the pressure on this administration. It means being militant, it means hitting the streets, and frankly, it means being a little bit disrespectful.
That was Bill Fletcher, Jr., co-author of Solidarity Divided, The Crisis in Organized Labor and a New Path Towards Social Justice. Read his articles at blackcommentator.com, where he serves as a member of the editorial board, or at zcommunications.org. In early September, Israeli President Benjamin Netanyahu and Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas came to Washington to begin direct peace talks at the behest of President Obama. The Middle East leaders were accompanied by the presidents of Jordan and Egypt to demonstrate regional support for this new effort at negotiations. Netanyahu and Abbas declared their first meeting a positive step and planned to meet every 2 weeks for a year, with the goal of finalizing a settlement to a conflict that's gone on even longer than the 62 years Israel has officially existed. The leaders have pledged to take up the thorniest so-called permanent status issues sooner rather than later. They include establishing borders, Jerusalem as a shared capital, the future of Israeli settlements in the West Bank, the right of Palestinian refugees to return to their homes, and the equitable sharing of scarce water resources. These issues have often been key elements in scuttling previous attempts at brokering a peace agreement. Abbas is negotiating on behalf of Fatah, the largest party within the Palestinian Liberation Organization, which governs the West Bank. while Hamas, that controls Gaza, is not included in the negotiations. The talks are being brokered by Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and former Senator George Mitchell, U.S. Special Middle East Peace Envoy. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Hussein Ibish, senior fellow at the American Task Force on Palestine, who assesses this latest round of Middle East peace talks and the obstacles that stand in the way of reaching an agreement.
Neither of the parties was particularly keen, it would appear, to enter into these negotiations. But the Obama administration was insisting, and really I think the reality of them is a kind of testament to American influence and the determination of the administration. They really weren't willing to take no for an answer. They started in on this issue on the very first day of Obama's, after he was inaugurated. The talks themselves are something of an accomplishment for the administration. It's not substantive, of course. It doesn't change anything, but it wasn't easy. Another thing is that you've got, for the first time in a long time, publicly, Israeli and Palestinian leaders coming forward and saying they want to talk, they are talking, and they want to do a deal, and they think a deal can be done. Now, you know, of course, it would be perfectly reasonable to speculate that they're just saying that. But on the other hand, they both have to be tested. And there isn't any way to test them outside the context of direct negotiation. The third thing that I think is a little different is that, you know, the kind of starkness of the alternatives is clearer now than it was 10 years ago or 5 years ago. I think it's really very clear where the conflict is going without a movement towards an agreement. I think you can see it both in Israeli society and in Palestinian society, the shift towards the religious right and the kind of slow drift of the conflict away from an ethnic one over land and power, basically a political conflict, into one that's much more based on religion and the will of God in holy places that really will be much more difficult to resolve in any way.
Hussein Ibish, what about the role of Hamas? You know, George Mitchell, who mediated the settlement in Northern Ireland and is trying to reach the peace deal between Israel and Palestine, famously said the way they reached agreement in Northern Ireland was by bringing all the parties to the table, even those who were accused with good reason of being terrorists. Now somebody asked point blank, what's the role of Hamas? And he said none. And in fact, it looks like they have none. So how can there be a solution?
Hamas has no role. That's perfectly clear. None of the three parties involved in the negotiations, Israel, the PLO, and the United States wants them there. And Hamas doesn't accept the basic framework of the talks either. So it's not clear at all that Hamas wants to be there. I don't see any evidence that they do. You know, if you begin with the premise that you'll never recognize Israel under any circumstances, it becomes very hard for you to be part of the negotiations for a Palestinian state alongside of Israel. It's just you ruled out the end game already. However, of course, it's very true that Hamas is an important political player and represents an important constituency. So at a certain point, when you start to get closer to an agreement and really looks like you're going to have one, and you have to think in terms of, as a practical matter, having one, and what do you do about Hamas's constituency, Hamas itself, and the area they rule in Gaza, and how do you deal with that? And there are many ways of dealing with it, especially because I think it's going to be politically extremely difficult for Hamas if that happens. I think almost impossible. And the organization is going to be faced with some incredibly difficult choices. But it's at that point that you really have to start looking for practical solutions to the problem. At the moment, you've got the Palestine Liberation Organization, the PLO, which is, by every document, the sole legitimate representative of the Palestinian people. They are authorized to negotiate with Israel on national matters. There's a practical reality that there's another Palestinian party that has to be taken into consideration. The ability of Hamas to reach beyond the core constituency that actually believes in their very conservative religious fundamentalist politics, which is probably about 15 or 17% of Palestinians, but their ability to reach beyond that to bigger constituencies is predicated on a lack of hope for peace and circumstances of despair that make their message of, or at least the rhetoric of armed struggle, appealing to a bigger number of Palestinians. You know, insofar as people really are very cynical about the possibility of peace, Hamas's approach looks good, but as you get closer and closer to a reality in which, you know, if it does happen, where the PLO strategy of the negotiations seems to be about to produce a result or is leading, you know, almost inexorably to a result of independence, it's going to be very hard for Hamas. And I think they're going to end up splitting along several axes. I don't know if the group will break up, but it'll certainly be incredible divisions between those who are more oriented towards Palestinian nationalism and would want to be involved in the new Palestinian state and vying for power and participating in all of that, and those who are more oriented regionally to the Muslim Brotherhood movement. Arab world or to allies in Iran and Syria.
That was Hussein Ibish of the American Task Force on Palestine. Contact the task force by calling area code 202-887-0177 or visit their website at americantaskforce.org. A massive recall of eggs linked to salmonella contamination began on August 13th after the Centers for Disease Control announced the eggs were connected to more than 1,300 reported cases of salmonella poisoning. Overall, a half billion eggs were recalled nationwide. The Food and Drug Administration has opened a criminal investigation with the Justice Department as the federal agency looks into the cause of the outbreak. FDA inspectors who visited Wright County Egg Company in Iowa, one of the egg farms at the center of the salmonella outbreak, reported finding rodents, flies, maggots, and chicken manure piled as high as 8 feet tall. Chickens can contract salmonella bacteria from rodent droppings, which pass to the bird's ovaries and then inside the egg. Ironically, new, stricter FDA regulations on preventing salmonella contamination at large egg farms had gone into effect in July. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Patty Lovera, assistant director of the group Food and Water Watch. She discusses the egg recall in the context of large-scale factory farming and the danger to consumers without adequate food safety inspections and enforcement.
Eggs have salmonella in them because the chickens had salmonella in their system. And then the question is, well, how did the chickens, you know, get exposed to salmonella and have it in their systems? And so there are several different ways it can happen. So there's a lot of focus for large operations raising birds to keep out mice and rats because rodents could bring in salmonella. And if their feces is in there, you could get salmonella that way. They're worried about wild birds. But they're also worried about what the chickens are eating. And so the investigation, I believe, is also going on at the company that both these firms that recalled eggs were buying feed evidently from the same company. So they're worried about the feed coming out of that operation as well. So there's different angles they have to run down. But, you know, the focus of preventing salmonella, a lot of it is on sanitation. It's keeping these facilities kind of contained and trying to keep out these sources of salmonella. But we also want to hear more, and I hope that we do hear more, about how big these operations were and what kind of conditions, you know, the chickens are being raised in, what kind of stress they're under, and what role that plays. Because there's a lot of controversy about putting so many animals in one facility and if that makes them more susceptible to diseases like salmonella.
You often hear that the Food and Drug Administration and other agencies of the government don't have enough inspectors to really ensure in a very foolproof way the safety of our food here in this country. What's the system in place for egg production? I read that there recently was some new regulations put in place at the federal level to do more intense inspection of eggs. I think that was back in July.
Right, and that's one. I mean, there's always an issue of resources, and the FDA is in charge of eggs that are in the shell, like that are involved in this recall. They're in charge of produce, you know, vegetables and fruit. They're in charge of fish and processed food. So they have a lot of the food supply, and they don't have a lot of inspectors to go out, and they don't get to plants very often, and that's been a historic problem we've had to deal with. When it comes to eggs, they also didn't have rules for a long time. It took over a decade, actually, for the FDA to put out rules on what big companies should do to prevent salmonella in eggs. They just went into effect in July, so we haven't really even seen them, you know, use them and get them up and running and go out and inspect and see if they're being followed before we had this dramatic example of, you know, what can go wrong.
Patty, I read that your group, Food and Water Watch, has stated that currently most eggs produced in the United States are from just five states, and some of these very giant egg production houses, factory farms, and that your group would be in favor of decentralizing, that it should be not just five states or a handful of these big chicken egg factories, but in fact smaller farms that presumably could have a higher quality control. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, and this is, you know, this is across our food system at this point, but eggs are actually a very good example of how really concentrated everything has gotten. You know, it's not like the picture on the package anymore where we've got these very small farms with just a handful of chickens and maybe a couple cows. I mean, we've really specialized and concentrated this food production. So we have five states that produce half the eggs in the country. You know, 12 companies, there are 12 companies that produce eggs that have more than 5 million chickens laying eggs for them. So most eggs that people buy are coming from, you know, what we would call a factory farm, a very large operation that's got, you know, 75,000, 100,000 chickens. So this is not the picture on the package, and it's a different type of production, and we think that, you know, the regulations have not kept up with the risks that come with this type of facility. So there's lots of folks that are interested in raising chickens a different way. You know, we need to help them figure out where and how to do that and reconnect, you know, consumers and smaller producers and have the processing and the links you need to restore kind of local production like that. If for no other reason than they're smaller operations, and if something does go wrong, you're not going to have half a billion eggs involved. It's going to be smaller numbers. We think there's also a lot of differences in the type of eggs you get out of that system.
How would you gauge the influence of the big agriculture companies on our regulatory system here to keep our food safe? Obviously, these guys got a lot of money, and they want to maximize their profit. But are they pretty successful at diluting regulations?
Sadly, across the board, yeah, they are. And that goes from, you know, what are the standards for, you know, environmental permits for facilities like this to what are the labels that are on our food. I mean, we're always kind of running up against big agricultural interests whenever you're talking about something like this. And in eggs, you know, it took 10 years for there to be an FDA standard on salmonella in eggs because the industry didn't want to be regulated. They kept saying, let us do a voluntary program. Let us do this instead. We don't need a regulation. Why don't we just get some guidance? You know, I mean, there's all these suggestions they have instead because they really don't want to be regulated. And that goes across the board.
That was Patty Lovera, Assistant Director of the group Food and Water Watch. Contact the group at area code 202-683-2500 or visit their website at foodandwaterwatch.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.